Listen up, people. We've got one last chance to double your impact when you donate during this May fundraiser. It's Match Monday, and the Investors Challenge Fund is matching donations today only up to $25,000. We need to put every single dollar of these funds to use for our newsroom in the months ahead so we can keep you and people across this country informed. Please give right now and generously at marketplace.org/donate. And thanks.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Hey, quick, how do you say interest rate increase in Turkish? Anybody know? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 22nd of June today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The macroeconomic news of this Thursday comes to us via London and Oslo and Bern and Ankara, courtesy of the central banks of, in order, England, Norway, Switzerland, and Turkey, all of which raised their key interest rates today. It's a pretty clear example, I'd say, of the tendency that the world central bankers have to do pretty much the same thing at the same time. And for those listening at this point saying, but Kai, the Fed skipped this past meeting. Well, yes, true, they did, but they also promised, all but promised, I suppose, more rate hikes later on this year. So we asked Marketplace's Kristen Schwab to explain that herd mentality.
Central banks are often making the same moves because, more often than not, economic problems are global problems. Bill English is a finance professor at Yale.
The central bankers are responding to the same shocks. They're big shocks. And so the appropriate policy is similar.
And what appropriate monetary policy looks like right now is because of the pandemic, supply chain problems, and the war in Ukraine. Since the problems are so similar, there's a sort of groupthink that happens. Central banks watch and discuss everyone else's moves with each other at official meetings and behind closed doors. Even so, in most packs, a leader eventually emerges.
Bank of England began tightening policy, for example, a few months before the Fed did in response to the high inflation.
It's why the Bank of England's recent rate hike could offer a clue for what's to come in the U.S. Bill Emmons is a professor at Washington University of St. Louis and a former economist at the St. Louis Fed.
I think this points in the direction of saying, oh, the Fed probably has more to do. And they've been behind the curve through most of this episode.
Turns out the U.S. being behind the curve, following others, is kind of common. Peter Conte Brown is a professor of financial regulation at Wharton.
Almost all the innovations we have seen in the practice of monetary policy, with a few exceptions, came from other central banks.
Including the Fed's 2% inflation target. That came from the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. Conte Brown says this group mentality in central banking, it's a part of the culture, and it's a reason why no one nation really strays from the pack.
There was a time, in fact, when the three heads of the central banks in Europe and in the United Kingdom and in the U.S. all had the same dissertation advisor at MIT, who was in turn the head of the central bank in Israel.
And he says there are risks to that groupthink. It can turn central banks into less of a pack with a leader and more of a herd. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Today's Marketplace trivia question, who was that dissertation advisor? Wall Street Today traders were in central bank tea leaf reading mode. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The The Federal Reserve has been having some success getting prices back under control, some. But inflation has been above the Fed's 2% target that Kristen was just talking about for more than 2 years now, which means businesses have had plenty of time to figure out how to raise prices to cover their higher costs, and then some, actually. But when big businesses raise prices, they've got reams of data they can pore over about how their customers and their competitors might react and what those companies should do in response. Small businesses, though, do not have that luxury. So Marketplace's Justin Ho went out and talked to some small business owners about how they make decisions in raising prices. And he started in a bike shop in Newbury Park, California.
The store is called Worldwide Cyclery. It specializes in high-end mountain bikes, bike components, and clothing. Almost 20,000 products from over 200 different brands. And owner Jeff Cayley says when it comes to setting the price of most of it, he doesn't have much flexibility.
All those different brands will have different policies from here's a minimum advertised price, here's a window where there's, you know, 1 month a year where you can go below that price. You can or cannot use discount codes.
Then there are the products that Cayley makes himself. He opens up a new box of bike pedals.
Here you are. So a composite pedal, that means the whole kind of casing of the pedal is made out of a really hard, durable composite material.
Manufacturing some of these products has gotten more expensive recently. So a few months ago, he raised the cost of his carbon fiber handlebars by about 7%. But sometimes, raising prices has nothing to do with the cost of the product itself.
Whether that's even just, you know, the lease on the building that we have or our labor costs or even just things like electricity and utilities costs, is like those things inch up, we need to have a larger gross margin in order to accommodate for that.
Kelly has to balance all of that against what customers are willing to pay. He says the bike industry boomed in the early days of the pandemic, and he could pretty much raise prices and trust that people would pay them.
In our industry, those days have passed us. Back during, you know, 2021, 2022, consumers were much more accepting of that.
Cayley says he and his staff keep a close eye on what competitors are charging. Sometimes they've even reduced their prices. And when the store decides to raise prices, it experiments to see how increases land.
You know, we'll adjust something, run a test, see what happens, go back to the drawing board. So it's kind of a never-ending game.
And a lot of it comes down to a business owner's experience.
I'm relying on, like, my gut and my intuition a lot.
That's Jess Harrington. She runs a company in the Boston area that stages homes that are up for sale, makes them look good with furniture, paint, and lighting. Harrington says she's raised her prices about 25% over the last 2 years, mostly because she's had to buy a lot of new furniture and other equipment and rent a bigger warehouse to store it all.
I must have like between 60 and 70 sofas. I have a lot of dining tables. I can't even tell you. I have a room that's dedicated to textiles and to linens.
Harrington says she could probably raise her prices even more since demand for her service has been pretty high lately. But in her industry, she says there are limits.
There is always that just sort of, you know, the feeling that like, what if I raise my prices and no one ever hires me again.
There is one way to figure out what kind of price increase customers will take. Just ask them.
That's how you get data. You have to ask. It can't be out of the sky. Oh, I think they can afford it. You know, it's asking.
That's Marcia St. Hilaire Finn, who owns Bright Star Early Care and Preschool in Washington, D.C. She's raised her prices between 3 and 5% every year since the pandemic started. And once per quarter, she surveys her customers. St. Hilaire Finn says, yeah, no one's ever happy to hear that they'll have to pay more for childcare. But when she gets the surveys back, she says,
they're like, yeah, we get it. Yes, that's fine.
As part of the survey, St. Hilaire Finn says she tries to be transparent about why she's raising prices.
We need, in order to continue that service, the teachers do need a raise, right? Benefits, we provide benefits. Real estate goes up by 3% every year. So the minimum we can raise this is at least by 4%.
One thing St. Hilaire Finn's been doing to keep her price increases to a minimum is cutting back on investment.
Maybe we'll forego getting that new playground. We can do what we have is fine. It's just not up to date. The kids are still having fun on the old playground.
And as long as her income covers the cost of doing business, St. Hilaire Finn says she's okay with that. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
If you remember reading the Iliad when you were in high school, what you probably remember most about the ancient Greek epic is that it is epically long. So it makes sense of a sort that according to the Federal Trade Commission, Amazon named the process by which customers could cancel their Amazon Prime memberships the Iliad flow. The FTC has sued Amazon, saying, quote, "The primary purpose of the Prime cancellation process was not to enable subscribers to cancel, but rather to thwart them." Amazon said the suit is, and this is also a quote, "false on the facts and the law." Other companies, of course, have been accused of making it difficult to stop paying them. As Marketplace's Matt Levin explains, the subscription cancellation dance is a bit of economic art and science.
I actually have been thinking of ditching one of my subscriptions, my current internet service. Shockingly, my current provider does not have a big red cancel button amongst the options on the membership or help page.
Restart modem, no thank you. Perform a speed test, already did that. Didn't find what you were looking for? No.
If you Google it, though, you can find a cancellation page that does not involve calling an 800 number or going into a physical store.
We are sorry to see you go. We take our customer security seriously, so we'll give you a call within 2 days to verify this request.
They know very well, probably from experience with millions of other customers, that if we find it difficult to cancel, we're just going to keep paying.
Jean-Pierre Dubé is an economist at the Chicago Booth School of Business.
We're going to pay it grudgingly, but we'll just keep paying because the hassle far outweighs the cost.
Dubé himself is still paying for a landline he doesn't use. It comes with his internet, and it's a pain to change his bundle.
Well, this is what's called a switching cost.
Dubé says companies tend to artificially inflate switching costs when there's not much difference between them and the competition. Think telecom. Stanford Business School professor Navdeep Sani says while these elaborate cancellation mazes can retain some customers, they're bad for the brand.
Consumers are keeping a score. So they may not respond immediately, but they are taking a note.
That being said, those mazes are still pretty complicated, even for people who research them for a living. Sani has long wanted to cut the cord on his cable TV subscription.
And I've even tried to cancel it one time, got convinced not to. That whole process is a long one.
Sani got offered some free channels to stay. He says that promotion expired years ago. But he's still a paying customer. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Yeah, I slept like 6 hours the other day. It was great.
Six is better than less, I guess. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 4 points today. We'll call that flat, 33,946. The NASDAQ went up 128 points. That is 0.9%, 13,630. S&P 500 rose 16 points, almost 0.4%, 43.81. We were hearing from Justin Ho about how some small businesses, including that bike shop, are figuring out how to raise prices. So in some cycling stocks, why don't we? Vista Outdoor fell 1.6%. Peloton Interactive lost 0.7%. But if you're biking inside, are you really biking? Darden Restaurants, which owns Olive Garden, don't at me. Other Olive Garden and other chains reported earnings of $2.75 billion, meeting analyst expectations. That represents a 6.4% rise in sales for the quarter, fueled in part by Longhorn Steakhouse. Darden fell 2.5% today. Bond prices fell as well. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 3.79%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Undergraduate enrollment in this country since the pandemic began is down more than a million students. In that same period, though, historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, are seeing an increase in enrollments and a pickup in philanthropic and corporate donations. Still, though, HBCUs lag other institutions economically, so we've gotten Dr. Andre Perry on the phone to talk things over. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Could you give us a quick thumbnail sketch of the current state of HBCU funding in this country, please?
The 10 largest HBCU endowments in 2020 totaled just $2 billion, compared to $200 billion across the top primarily white institutions. HBCUs are chronically underfunded due to largely to state underinvestment, lower alumni contributions, and lower Black incomes and wealth. So those endowments really reflects the loss of wealth in Black individuals.
So given this moment, or the moment we had, I suppose, in 2020 after the murder of George Floyd and the increased interest in Black economic development in this country, are you surprised that HBCUs still are where you point out that they are?
I'm not surprised, because after 2020, there was a lot of philanthropic giving. People wanted to respond to George Floyd's tragedy by giving essentially sympathy dollars. But that kind of funding is really not the kind of funding that we would consider investment. Given the pound for pound impact that HBCUs provide to communities, you would think there'd be greater investment. But and as a result, the communities are also suffering. The communities that host the HBCUs are also suffering, because colleges and universities are, by default, are the economic development organizations in those places.
So there is obviously an element, a sizable element of structural economic racism in the reasoning behind HBCUs not being as endowed and invested in as they ought to be. But you wrote a piece at Brookings last year in which you point out that HBCUs, There is a need to understand that story better and for them to tell the story better.
Yeah, you know, the HBCUs are doing such a great job of graduating students. And we just need to understand how much that matters to the community overall. The amount of the degrees that they produce, the amount of money those graduates produce, it's not reflected in the overall investment in those institutions. And as a result, those institutions are struggling a bit. In addition, HBCUs are treated like Black people. So you don't see The kinds of investments overall, which leads to less land and property acquisition. You don't see investments in the sports teams. You saw that during the Jackson State, Deion Sanders issues. We're just not seeing the investment but it's in the face of production overall.
Right. Okay. So we talked about George Floyd and what that could conceivably have meant for HBCUs in this economy. I want to take sort of the flip side of that coin and ask you about the state of Florida and Governor DeSantis and his efforts to quash and squash DEI in that state and the spread of it to others. It does seem a perilous moment for HBCUs.
Yeah, most HBCUs do not have DEI programs. However, what DeSantis is doing is really challenging the notion of should we have an HBCU? And that's a question that comes up all the time. And it's really shameful given the production of HBCUs. But remember that if it were not for HBCUs, if it were not for the Black teachers that came out of HBCUs, we would not have had the advancements in knowledge around slavery, Jim Crow, racism, discrimination, because we clearly see a reticence to learn those subjects. So we need to continuously fund and support these institutions.
Dr. Andre Perry is a senior fellow at Brookings, where he studies, among other things, education and leadership. Dr. Perry, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Most people who own homes in this country are hanging on to them. The number of existing homes, that is, not new construction, used homes, if you will, the number sold in May was 20% lower than it was a year ago, so says data out this morning from the National Association of Realtors. And even if they want to move, people who bought or refinanced even a couple of years back aren't much interested in giving up a 3% mortgage if buying a house now means having to pay 6%. So Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes looked at what, if anything, could get people moving.
Sleepovers are not really doable in Kate Sam's household.
You can hear everything from anywhere.
Sam has two kids, ages 4 and 8, and she'd like to sell their small home in Baltimore to buy a bigger place so they could host sleepovers. But Sam and her husband refinanced their mortgage in 2021 at a rate of 3%. And now?
It's just unimaginable to give up the current cost.
Lots of people are choosing to stay put, even if they'd rather sell. Lawrence Yoon, chief economist of the National Association of Realtors, says he actually expects there to be fewer divorces this year.
The couple may not like each other, but they love their 3% mortgage rate, so they don't want to give that up.
Yoon says others may avoid taking new jobs if it means relocating. But there are certain life changes that might cause people to make a move, even at these higher rates. Like having a third child when you live in a two-bedroom condo. Jonathan Miller leads Miller Samuel, a real estate appraisal and consulting firm in New York.
At some point, the financial benefit of staying in the same space loses its luster, so to speak.
Others want less space and a different layout, says Mark Goldman, a loan officer with C2 Financial Corporation, a mortgage brokerage.
A lot of people, when they age, they want a bedroom on the first floor. They don't want to be dealing with stairs.
And then there are those sales where the seller won't need to buy a new place.
What I've been suggesting to my real estate agents is watch the obituaries. You know, a lot of times when somebody passes away, the kids don't want the house. They want the cash.
And if rates do eventually go down, say back into the 5% range, appraiser Jonathan Miller says he expects all those people who've been holding out to stick up a for sale sign so they can finally get divorced or host that sleepover. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Justin Ho was telling us a little bit ago about how businesses figure out when and by how much they should raise prices to try to keep up with inflation or maybe get ahead of it.
And as we heard, it's a lot easier to make those decisions when you've got years of experience under your belt. So what's it like when you've got 1 year under your belt? Welcome to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name's Larry Groves.
And my name's Ricky Barossa.
And we're the owners of the Growing Groves plant shop in Davis, California. We have people come into the store and they're like, you guys have been here for like 2 or 3 years now, right? And we're like, nope, it's been 13 months. You know? And we both kind of feel like we've aged 10 years in 1 year, just because when you have a small business, you work 8 days a week, 27 hours a day, and it's just like nonstop. Also, like being able to pay off all of our business loans in the first year, you know, not taking paychecks, making sure that the store's paid off within the first year, and like it's ours. We own it, and like it's a great feeling.
In the past year, I think just learning about our customer base here in Davis, trying to understand what they like, what they don't like, how do we deal with the prices, I think that's been very, very illuminating. We just have a good relationship with our customers, and we ask them, like, what would you like to see? Like, what should we bring to the store?
My goal when we opened the store was, like, we need to be affordable to everyone. Mm-hmm. Because plants are a luxury, but they shouldn't be a luxury price. Mm-hmm. We have had to increase the price of some things because of inflation. Mm-hmm. But a dollar on top of whatever the price of something was before isn't going to impact as much as other places where something was already pretty pricey and now it's going up a few dollars in price and they're not going to be able to sell it because it's too expensive. It was already a luxury price and now it's an unachievable luxury price, you know?
Yeah. And of course, we're worried about like just, you know, sales and stuff, like normal business stuff. But I think just the way that we're rolling out the business slowly, it definitely helps us just, you know, deal with issues.
Yeah, we're still guessing, but, you know. We're definitely sleeping more than we were like 8 months ago. Now we have a couple days off and we can like focus on spending more time together and not be together in the store, mm-hmm. which is really great.
Yeah, we can definitely recharge and come back to the store refreshed and ready to see what we can change or update or whatever.
Yeah, I slept like 6 hours the other day. It was great.
Larry Groves and Ricky Barossa feeling well rested up in Davis, California. If your small business is keeping you up at night, or if you are finally getting some shut-eye, we want to hear about it. Marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, some new data out from the Labor Department on how we spend our time. It is called, conveniently enough, the American Time Use Survey. Here is just one tidbit. On days they worked, the survey says, 34% of people who were employed did some or all of their work at home. 69% did some or all of their work at the office. Here, though, is the kicker, and I would ask that all bosses in the audience and within the sound of my voice cover their ears. On average, those who worked at home in this economy worked 5.4 hours a day. Those who worked in the office, 7.9. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. And really, it's more like a moment of, really? In 2023? One more from the Time Use Survey. On an average day, 22% of men in this economy did housework. That's cleaning, laundry, what have you. Compared to 47% of women in 2023. What are we even doing? John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawi is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.